Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. India's sixth largest city is running out of water. Chennai is home to about 10 million people, and they're parched. Reservoirs are dry. Pipes that are supposed to carry water into the city are empty. Municipal taps are turned on for only a few hours a week. And trains are arriving every few days with emergency water supply. Residents who can afford it buy truckloads of water from private tankers, while others wait days for trucks to bring in free deliveries. Climate change is one reason for the crisis, but so is government mismanagement of resources. So this hour in Point, what lessons does a dried-out Chennai hold for the rest of the world? And you can join us. Can you imagine a city roughly the size of New York with no water? As the climate changes and as weather becomes more unpredictable, what should we be doing to conserve water? And are cities around the world ready with their water infrastructure to handle a changing future? Join us anytime on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, we'll start today in Delhi, India, with Emily Schmall, South Asia correspondent for the Associated Press. She's been reporting on the water crisis in Chennai, and we have links to her reporting at On Point Radio. Emily, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So how close is Chennai to actually running out of water?
Well, it's been operating at a deficit for a number of years, actually. So technically speaking, it is out of water. At this point, it is pulling in water from a variety of sources. It's two desalination plants are, of course, converting seawater into potable water. And then, as you mentioned, it's taking water from a dam some ways off that it's carrying in every day via train. And then it has some groundwater reserves, but they're fast diminishing.
Mm. And so tell us then how are people coping when you're in Chennai reporting on this? How is the water shortage changing how people are living on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, well, I should say that Chennai, I think like a lot of cities, is sort of a tale of two cities, if you will, because on the one hand, in the wealthier southern part of the city, there are a lot of luxury hotels with swimming pools, there are shopping malls with fountains, there are other water amenities, and they don't seem to be struggling much, but that's because they primarily rely upon purchased water, which they get from outside Chennai. But for the people who rely on the Chennai water supply, it's really, really tough. There are some people who have as little as a few liters of potable water a day, and so they're having to make tough choices. Do they run a bath for their kids? Do they wash clothes? How much of it do they use to drink, and how much of it to boil water to cook food? So it's really drastic in some areas.
Huh. Now, Emily, I mentioned at the top of the show that they're bringing in some water via a train. Can you tell us more about that, and how does that work?
Yeah, so actually this is the second time in Chennai's history, and Chennai is a city that has always had really severe weather that's, of course, only been amplified by climate change. But it's always experienced periods of drought and actually also flooding. And that's partly just because of the location. But so Chennai is now doing what Chennai did in 2001, which is the last time it had a drought this severe, which is they are bringing water in these repurposed cooking oil tankers by train from about 150 miles off. And we actually went to the source where the train begins. It's 4-hour journey every day. And they had to, the state of Tamil Nadu, of which Chennai is the capital, approved this about $90 million crash engineering project to connect all of these pipes from a dam that was even further off to this train. And it's an extremely time-consuming process that involves a lot of manpower. And then the train doesn't arrive into Chennai until very late in the evening. The whole process takes about 16 hours. And at that point, the water is decanted into the city's water system, and trucks that take water to various neighborhoods around the city go and start picking it up in the morning and have long days, I should say, of making these deliveries.
Wow. Well, Emily Schmall, South Asia correspondent for the Associated Press. She's been reporting on the water crisis in Chennai. And as I mentioned, we have links to her reporting at onpointradio.org. Emily joining us today from Delhi, India. Thank you so much, Emily.
Thanks, Vigna.
Well, let's listen to the voice of a resident in Chennai named Bhavani, who spoke to German public broadcaster DW about her neighborhood and how they have to wait to get free water. Here she is.
We get water through that pump, but it is sewage water and has a foul smell. They will tell us to use that water for daily needs. At the other end of the same street, people get water delivered by water tanks every day, but we don't get it.
So a resident of Chennai there talking about the different access to water that people have in that city right now in the midst of a water crisis, depending on what neighborhood and what income they're at. Well, joining us now is Veena Srinivasan. She's with us from Bangalore, India. She's a fellow at the Ashoka Trust for Research in Ecology and the Environment, Bangalore, where she leads the Water, Land and Society program. Veena Srinivasan, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for having me.
So first of all, let me ask you, you have family members who are in Chennai. How are they coping right now with the lack of water?
Well, my dad lives in Chennai. And as Emily pointed out, I mean, there's a substantial difference between the rich and the poor. So my dad's able to both have a borewell, which although it looked like it had stopped functioning for a little bit, but they're able to buy tanker water. And that's private tanker water, so it's not the free tankers. And basically, then you're able to get by. And so, but the poor who aren't able to afford the tankers are the ones who have to wait for the free tanker delivery. And that tends to be unreliable. You've got to spend your work day waiting for it. And often you have to tip the tanker driver a significant amount of money. That actually, when you calculate on a per liter basis, is quite a substantial amount of money that you end up paying. So the poor end up paying more than the rich. They have less, and it's more reliable. So it's less reliable, and so they often have to lose days of wages as well.
So Veena, over the course of this hour, I want to explore with you the environmental and climate causes to Chennai's water crisis right now, but also very much the sort of government and infrastructure causes here. But let's start with climate. I mean, there are dramatic satellite photos that we've been seeing here in the United States of Chennai's major reservoirs as they run dry. Can Chennai rely on the rainy season to recharge those reservoirs?
So Chennai has always had actually insufficient reservoir capacity, but I think it's important for the audience to kind of clarify how Chennai is different, because a lot of people, and including on Twitter, I saw some comments that Chennai has actually quite a bit of rainfall. It has almost five feet of rainfall, or 1.2 meters of rainfall annually, which is much more than much of the United States. But the problem is all of that rain, because Chennai gets its rainfall from the northeast monsoon, which is kind of a cyclonic depression-driven monsoon. And so it gets all of its rain in very, very few days. And so so it seems like it's a lot of water, but it's a coastal city where all of the rain falls in very few days. And if anybody was following the news a few years ago, Chennai had exactly the opposite problem, that the entire city was underwater. So in 2015, there were devastating floods, and the city was completely submerged in water. So reservoirs then become a really important mediating infrastructure, which is going to allow you to capture the water in the few days of rain that you have, and allow you to use it through the dry season. And Chennai just doesn't have enough reservoir capacity. Now, it's not a terribly easy thing to fix, because Tamil Nadu, where Chennai is located, is also one of the most urbanized states in India, mm-hmm. which means there's a lot of people living everywhere. And it's a high density of population, high infrastructure state. And so it's not easy in this day and age to suddenly plonk a reservoir in the middle of all of that. Because generally, it's easier to put a reservoir in farmland or forest land, you know, where you don't have to buy out and displace millions of people. And so it's a complicated problem. It's a climatologically, it's a challenging terrain to work with. But then because of HNA, if it is in a state of development, it's also a singularly difficult problem to solve.
Yes.
Very easily.
So point taken on how complex this is, which is actually exactly the reason why this is a major issue for cities around the world, right? Because given various changes in climate, infrastructure, et cetera, the pattern of problems that Chennai is experiencing certainly must be familiar to other cities. I mean, we know it wasn't that long ago where in Sao Paulo or Cape Town, major global cities, again, they were talking about critical water shortages there. So we will get to that. But Veena, if I just may, because I want to understand the climatological reasons here as well. Regarding that northeast monsoon, has it been as reliable as usual? I've been hearing that even this year, perhaps there hasn't been as much rain.
Yes. So the northeast monsoon is generally less reliable than the other monsoon, which is the southwest monsoon. This year, the southwest monsoon, which is should be happening right now, has actually failed. So, in fact, we haven't had any rains at all, or very little rain in this part of India. Although for the south, there's been rains. But I think, in general, the northeast monsoon has become more and more erratic in recent years. And so it's taking a problem that was already bad to start with, and it's become worse.
Okay. And so then in that case, we have about 30 seconds before we have to take a quick break here, Veena. If the problem has become worse, what are the most immediate short-term fixes you recommend the city of Chennai undertake?
Well, I would definitely do all the low-hanging fruit first, which Chennai hasn't done. They were ahead of the game in promoting rainwater harvesting, and I would extend that to full-scale harvesting of rainwater stormwater. But I would definitely do the basic stuff like metering and pricing properly, because that hasn't happened. And then there's a lot more that can be done with imports from outside, but maybe that needs a longer conversation.
Okay, so we'll just take a quick break for 1 minute. We'll come back and have that longer conversation. We are talking about the water crisis in the Indian city of Chennai. It's roughly 10 million people, and the climate and infrastructure reasons behind that and what cities around the world could learn from it. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the Indian city of Chennai. It's roughly 10 million people and the water crisis that's currently unfolding there and the lessons that Chennai holds for the rest of the world, for major cities around planet Earth, about how to best manage an infrastructure where water becomes an increasingly precious resource. I'm joined today by Veena Srinivasan. She joins us from Bangalore, India. She's a fellow at the Ashoka Trust for Research in Ecology and the Environment, Bangalore, where she leads the Water, Land and Society program. We have a link to her article headlined, Wake Up! There's No Water. That link is at our website, onpointradio.org. And also joining us now from Tempe, Arizona, is Rimchim Agarwal. She's an associate professor at the School of Sustainability at Arizona State University. Her research focuses on examining the links between globalization, social, ecological systems, and human well-being. Professor Agarwal, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So you heard Veena before the break talk to us about some of the climatological reasons behind Chennai's current water crisis. I'd like to explore with both of you also just the infrastructure, governmental and planning reasons behind this as well. I mean, we should note that, first of all, Chennai has grown extremely rapidly in the past several decades, going in a century from what, 500,000 people to almost 10 million people. Has that growth been managed in the right way, or is it part of the problem here? Professor Agarwal, go ahead.
Yes, the issue of rapid urbanization is an important one here. So as the city has grown, it has also paved over some of the lakes and water bodies that were historically there. So Chennai metropolitan area, it is estimated, had something like 4,000 lakes. But as the urbanization pressure grew, there was development, housing development over those water bodies. And that has impacted the flow of water and the water supply that existed earlier there. And then there is also the question that Veena was pointing out earlier about untreated sewage flowing into the water bodies. And then you cannot use that water. And one of your guests was talking about how the water that they are getting smells of sewage. Mm-hmm. So that is a major issue also connected with poor planning.
Mm. Veena, chime in here. I mean, how has Chennai's rapid growth been contributed to this water crisis?
I mean, absolutely. And Chennai by no means is unique. I mean, it's true of all Indian cities because they're growing so rapidly that it's impossible at some level for the infrastructure to keep pace with the rate of growth. And that has led to, of course, there's the entire, you know, paving over everything. But I think the roots of that lie deeper in kind of the way our engineering bureaucracy is set up. Because the engineering bureaucracy definitely thinks about water supply as being, I get water from distant reservoirs, I supply it to households, I get paid for water supply, they generate sewage, and then I will treat the sewage, but only when I absolutely have to, because there's no regulatory or monetary incentive for them to actually do anything about the sewage side. Now, the way this of course leads to all of the contamination issues. The woman talked about groundwater being contaminated because what she was talking about was pump, the hand pump. So parts of Chennai have fairly shallow groundwater. So the groundwater hadn't been contaminated completely with sewage. That could have been, an alternative backup source for poorer households. But it is in the coastal areas. You have seawater ingress, and then within Chennai you have a contamination. And the reason is we generally in India do a terrible job of wastewater management because that is absolutely the stepchild of a water utility. They don't get paid to treat sewage. They get paid to deliver water, and then they don't get extra to treat sewage. And so we've lost a major opportunity in being able to think of wastewater as a resource the way some of the other developed economies have been able to do.
So Veena, if I may just ask though, also, who is consuming the water in Chennai? Because I'm seeing that there's a huge, the industry in Chennai, particularly the Indian automotive industry, might be a major source of the water consumption there. Is that uncontrolled?
For most part, the industrial consumption, I don't actually have numbers for these because most industrial and commercial consumption in Indian cities is groundwater, and groundwater is unregulated. And so nobody actually has a good sense of, if you had to ask me, can you put a number on how much that is, it would be hard to say. I could say it's somewhere between 20% and 40% of the total consumption, but I would be hard-pressed to narrow it down beyond that because of the complete absence of data, but also because it's unregulated and everybody's just drilling their bore wells and pumping. So that's a difficult question to answer. How much are they responsible for the lack of water?
I see. But when we're considering sort of what long-term solutions are for cities like Chennai, you would agree that we have to look at all the consumers of that water. It's not just residents. It's agriculture.
Absolutely. And industry is actually a big opportunity because they are the most likely candidates for purchasing and reusing of treated wastewater. And there are parts of industrial estates in north of Chennai that have been receiving treated wastewater for many years. But it's just the uptake of treated wastewater is just not enough compared to the amount that industry actually uses. And there's much, much more that can be done in that regard.
So, Professor Agarwal, let me turn back to you for a moment here, because as we've mentioned several times, this problem isn't unique to Chennai. What parallels, though, do you see between what that Indian city is dealing with now and, I mean, Sao Paulo and Cape Town are the ones that come to mind most immediately that have had recent water crises?
Yes, it is a much broader problem all over the world, I would say. So in the case of both Cape Town and Sao Paulo, the driving forces were the same that you mentioned, rapid urbanization, growing consumption, the climate getting drier. In case of Cape Town, similarly, the reservoirs were going dry. And in January 2018, the government declared that if the reservoirs the reservoir levels go beneath, it was about 13% of capacity, that they would cut off the tap supply. And that was a drastic news, which then led to various kinds of conservation measures being put in place. They tried various ways to improve efficiency. And then, unfortunately, the rains were there to avert the disaster. They had predicted that the zero day would occur around mid-May, but fortunately, there were some rains. But what it points to is these broader issues that we are talking about are the same in Cape Town. It's also a city with very wide inequalities, both on racial and economic terms. So there are consumers heavy consumers of water, as well as people who cannot afford to buy the water that comes through private supply. So very similar issues related to management of reservoirs, reservoir capacity, climate change, and overconsumption.
It's interesting because, I mean, at the same time, we heard a little earlier in this hour the tape from the Chennai resident who said that in her neighborhood they have to wait a long time for the water to be trucked in. But as we noted before, in more affluent neighborhoods, they're able to buy, at least as of now, still as much water as they need, though at very high prices. I mean, if I remember correctly, did not the United Nations name water, the access to water, as a fundamental human right?
Yes. So in 2010, the UN General Assembly recognized water as a human right. And what that implies is that everyone, irrespective of economic status and without discrimination, is entitled to safe, affordable, sufficient water. And that is one way that we can protect the rights of these highly vulnerable people. So what the human right implies is that the government has an obligation to provide all of its citizens this safe, sufficient, affordable supply of water. And this is a way that citizens can hold governments accountable for mismanagement of water. Mm. And this could be a way that also various non-governmental organizations, citizen groups, advocacy groups can, they can use this language of human rights to advocate for better management and also organize. It's also the society's responsibility. So as you said, the responsibility is widely shared. Yeah. And human rights is a mechanism that we can assure that these people don't get left out.
So let me turn back to Veena Srinivasan on that. Is sort of demanding the fundamental human right of access to water a lever that the people of Chennai can use to get further action from both the state and federal governments in India?
Well, it could be, but I think it's a double-edged sword because what often happens is when you make the demand of getting water from based on a human right to water, what we've seen in case after case after case, and I've observed this in high-level meetings in India as well, that often it will be the most expensive, insane projects that are being justified because they're like, look, the people of Chennai have now demanded water based on the human right. And so now we need to, you know, do the interlinking of rivers project, or you need to bring interbasin transfers from across the Western Ghats, and we need to cut down these, you know, whatever, so many million acres of forest. And so I think when I've basically advocated, I try to use a more balanced approach, saying water is a human right, and it needs, you know, everybody has the right to water, but we need to do the simple stuff first before we do the expensive, crazy stuff. And I would say that the most important thing that Indian utilities don't do a good job of is we don't have plans. So we don't have anything which you, if you try to go and look at Chennai Metro Water's website, you're not going to see a plan saying, here's kind of the projected population, here's the amount of sewage we're generating, here's the amount of stormwater we're generating, here's the aquifer capacity, here's, you know, Singapore often talks about the four taps, which is stormwater, rainwater, pipe water, and groundwater. And basically, a city which is that hard-pressed should be quantifying all of those things as well as the water used from the different sectors. You should then have kind of projections and then have a very rational assessment. Instead, what you get is a knee-jerk-based reaction, which is let's now go and put in a whole bunch of crazy expensive projects. And so that always worries me about how we frame that demand.
Right. Well, I mean, it's not unique to India for politicians to gravitate to high-profile, high-price-tag major infrastructure projects, I would say. But let's quickly go to some callers here. Ven is calling from Dayton, Ohio. Ven, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say 30 days ago, I took a tour from Dayton, Ohio, to Nepal, to Mount Everest Base Camp, then came through Scandinavian Chennai and to my village 200 miles south, then to Scandinavian countries and home. I saw how this water is playing out right now. In Dayton, I'm doing a construction project, too much water, no construction is going on for the last 50 days. In Nepal, people are complaining it is receding. The snow is receding. In Chennai, I could not take bath. My brother was embarrassed, and he took me 200 miles away. And I went to a village in my hometown. The water used to be 1 foot below. Now it is 30 foot below. And they are saying if it goes one more feet below, they are done. They got to go 100 feet below. Then I come to Scandinavian countries, too much water. Mm. So this, I could see everywhere playing out.
Yeah. Ven, thank you so much for your call. So the different ways that water is available or not in, around the world. Let's go to Norbert, who's calling from Clearwater, Florida. Norbert, you're on the air.
Thank you very much. Good day. Yeah, I heard what all these people said. I'll be giving workshops worldwide about 2-3 major topics. One is the danger of electromagnetic fields and electric cars and Wi-Fi and what have you. And one theme I'm giving in my workshops, which are full-day seminars, I talk about 1-2 hours about water. And I just recorded last week in America a 3-hour program only about water. 3-hour program only about water. Mm-hmm. Now, Chennai is, of course, it's a bad situation, but just the tip of the iceberg. It doesn't really touch the global problem, which is we're running into a water crisis. The average person is not aware of it. They open the water tap and water comes out, which is questionable quality all over the world. The water is a questionable quality. And what happens now is that certain companies, among others, of course, the running Nestle company in the world, the biggest food company, mm-hmm. are buying the water rights, whether it's in Africa, whether it's in India, whether it's in America and Canada, they buy the water rights for a penny, like 30 million gallons a year in Canada, in California for $600, for $600. Right. Then they take that water, fill it up in bottles, and sell it to you for 12 million times the price they paid for that bottle.
Yeah, Norbert, I'm going to take it back from you there because it's an interesting point, and I want to turn it back to Professor Agarwal. Professor Norbert there pointing out the role that corporations essentially who buy water rights and turn that water into bottled water. Does that play a role here? Because they do pull massive amounts of water out of the ground.
Yes, certainly it plays a role. And this is where I think human rights can have a bite. I completely agree with Veena's argument that sometimes it is used in very extreme ways and leads to knee-jerk reactions. But we also have examples. And South Africa is a great example here because in their constitution, they have the human right to water enshrined. So there have been several cases where these instances of private companies buying the water is taken up to courts, and then the courts deliberate on this, because you can understand that these poor communities from whom the water is purchased at rock bottom prices, they have no bargaining power in these deals, and they come out at the short end in these deals. And so in that sense, I think the human rights could be a useful instrument, but as with every instrument, it needs to be used wisely and methodologically well, backed up by good evidence and good data.
Well, Professor Agarwal, stand by for just a moment. And Veena Srinivasan, hang on there. We are talking about Chennai's water crisis right now. It's an Indian city of 10 million people that's out of water. They're trucking it in and they're bringing it in by train. And what lessons does Chennai hold for the rest of the world when it comes to this most precious resource? We'll be back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the water crisis in the Indian city of Chennai. It's a city of roughly 10 million people. That makes it just along the same lines as New York City. So imagine if a city like New York had to have its water brought in by train or by truck. I mean, how would you cope if you had to wait in line for hours every day for a plastic bucket full of water? And if we think this is a problem limited to Chennai, of course, we remember Sao Paulo, Cape Town, and others have recently had major water crises. So globally, are cities around the world prepared for different climate patterns, for with the kind of infrastructure that we need to keep the water flowing for everybody? Let's listen to a Chennai resident here. This is Syed Hassan, who spoke to a reporter from the German public broadcaster DW back in June about the city's major water shortages.
We pay water tax, okay, every month, okay, as part of our taxes. And like I told you last month, what happened to my tax that I paid? Okay, I did not get even a drop of water. So that is one where the government has not stood up to its responsibilities.
Also in June, before a joint session of Parliament, Ramnath Kovind, the President of India, announced a newly formed ministry to deal with water issues. Here's the announcement from a clip with interpretation from Al Jazeera.
We must conserve water for our children and future generations. The creation of the new Ministry of Jal Shakti, Power of Water, is a decisive step in this direction, which will have far-reaching benefits. Through this new ministry, the systems related to water conservation and management will be made more effective.
That's the President of India before a joint session of Parliament in June. I'm joined today by Rimshim Agarwal. She's an associate professor at the School of Sustainability at Arizona State University. And also by Veena Srinivasan. She's with us from Bangalore, India. She's a fellow at the Ashoka Trust for Research in Ecology and the Environment, Bangalore. And Veena, let me ask you, I mean, specifically, what has the government proposed it will do or might do regarding the situation in Chennai?
Well, in terms of long-term measures, there's two or three flavors of it. One of them is to expand desalination capacity. Chennai, of course, is a coastal town and a coastal city. And so one of the things is they want to substantially increase the number of desalination plants. The second thing they want to do is to bring a pipeline from the Kaveri Basin, the metro reservoir, to Chennai City. So and the metro reservoir is a much larger reservoir, which supplies irrigation as well. It's a multi-purpose reservoir. And I think that is one of the key things that that Chennai has lacked so far. And so to have a much more large reservoir that it can access. And then the third thing is there's been a lot of talk about interlinking of rivers and bringing water from the northern states. And I think that's much more of a long-term, pie-in-the-sky kind of infrastructure project.
But Veena, I heard you say a little earlier before we took that break that that Chennai itself as a city, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it doesn't, at this point in time, if we looked, we couldn't find sort of a hydrological plan for the city? I mean,
it doesn't exist.
So it sounds like there's some basics here that that the city needs to undertake, or the state government there in India that could help the situation a great deal.
Yeah, I want to clarify one thing. But the city often will have the city utility will often have a utility plan, but their utility plan usually doesn't cover the other elements. So they basically say, here's a reservoir, where can we get some more reservoirs and supply it? But they will usually not look at groundwater, wastewater, and then stormwater. Those are the other three elements that we talk about when we talk about water-sensitive cities or integrated urban water management. And so if you only focus on where can I get water from these distant reservoirs, those tend to be expensive big-ticket infrastructure projects. And in India, because it's a democracy, you're always going to move either tiger reserves or cut down forests or displace millions of people. And those just tend to get delayed and have severe cost overruns.
Right.
And so really, if you wanted to say, how would the city plan better? I would say you have to look at all four taps. So you have to keep your eye on where can I get fresh water from, but also look at local stormwater, groundwater, and wastewater, and say, how do I manage all of these together? And that kind of a plan does not exist.
Okay. So you also, so you talked about rainwater harvesting, you talked about metering of water use, and about perhaps appropriately pricing water. So tell me more about that.
So if you heard the resident that spoke just before this, he said we pay a water tax. So Chennai, even now, charges a flat rate based on property size and not based on volumetric consumption. And that, I think, I find that it's just egregious because it's not like other Indian cities haven't figured it out. Bangalore has a pretty robust metering system, at least, metering and volumetric pricing system. And so I think if a city is that water scarce, I find it irresponsible to say that it hasn't got 100% metering in place or with some kind of volumetric tariff. And so what that tariff should be is kind of the second question, but I think we still first need to get the infrastructure of volumetric of metering and volumetric pricing in place first. And then you can talk about, well, where should we set the tiers and so on.
Yeah. So again, I think you mentioned earlier that these are the low-hanging fruit for the city of Chennai regarding water management. Professor Agarwal, would you like to respond to that?
Yes, I think we've been perhaps painting too bleak and negative a picture, but I think it would be worth remembering that a crisis also offers a lot of opportunity for transformation. Right now, you have citizens and the government very concerned about the situation. And I think this is an opportune moment to also think about how we can transform the system. And here I would quickly mention something that Veena had quickly sort of talked about but didn't have time to go in detail, which is about rainwater harvesting. And here it is important to note that Chennai has been ahead of the game. Back in 2003, they had mandated that all buildings have rainwater harvesting structures installed. And there was some early success associated with that program in the sense that groundwater levels came up a bit. But then the effectiveness of the program slowly wore down as implementation and enforcement was poor. And there had to be greater awareness and information dissemination about how do you actually do rainwater harvesting. But that rainwater harvesting is one part of this water cycle, the different elements of the water system that Veena was talking about. So we have, how do you harvest the rain that falls on the ground? How can you use that better together with grey water recycling and better management of the wastewater? I think all of these pieces together we have to think about it in a holistic manner of how we push that forward and leverage on the work that Chennai has already done on rainwater harvesting. Yeah. I think that is one of the important lessons that perhaps Chennai can offer to other cities.
Oh, so if I may, I heard you say that perhaps we're painting too dire a picture here. But again, just in my view only, it does seem pretty dire when water has to be trucked and trained in.
Yes, it is certainly very dire. What I meant was that one can also leverage that as an opportunity. I mean, it is difficult to say that. I'm sitting here in the U.S. Perhaps it's easier for me to say that. It is a dire situation if you think about all the hardship that it imposes on everyday life of people. For us sitting here, it is difficult to imagine how life is structured around when you get water.
Right.
So you have to wake up before dawn. You have to stand in queue and fill up that water and think about all this very unproductive use of water, plus all the anxiety and the implications it has on mental health, on, you know, nutrition, on your livelihood options, on other things that you could do with your time, such as taking care of your children or so it is certainly a dire situation, but I also wanted to put in a plug for, you know, using it as a as an opportunity for bringing about change.
Yeah. Point taken, actually, and I appreciate it very much. And I would add to that one thing that it doesn't matter where we're sitting in the world, including here in the United States. I think water and potable water that's available to all people is an issue everywhere. And it's cities that don't anticipate that and plan for it that get caught in these day zero situations. And I don't see how that, you know, that it's beyond the possibility of that happening somewhere in the United States as well, which is why we're having this conversation, because we do want to have, you know, hear what the lessons are that we can learn from places like Chennai. So let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Prakash, who's calling from Des Moines, Iowa. Prakash, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I just want to make a couple of things globally. Definitely in India, as you guys discussed, this is nothing new in Chennai. It was in 80s and 90s, and it also happened in cities like Hyderabad in 80s and 90s. There are some major projects. As you mentioned, politicians will gravitate towards expensive projects. As long as these projects are not considered as an income source for politicians, and continue those projects in the name of the public service and public utilities, such as desalination of, they have a huge ocean right on their doorstep, and desalination projects. And there are several rivers. There's Kaveri River. There was a huge battle between Karnataka state and the Tamil Nadu state for those waters. There's Krishna, Godavari rivers. So they can actually, there was Penna River is another one.
Yeah.
So if those projects of redirecting those waters are continued over government after government when their parties change, irrespective of which party comes to power, they have to keep the people in mind and improve the city, they would not have been in the situation right they are in.
Well, Prakash, thank you so much for your call. I appreciate it. And Veena, Prakash mentioned desalination projects, for example. We've had comments coming in online asking about desal as an option, but we yes, I mean, it's an option, expensive, high energy, and I've been reading that already in Chennai there's a desal plant that is putting very briny water into the local environment that might be causing problems.
So I think there's two things worth noting on this. Firstly, it's whether to ask whether how does desalination, that's getting water, fresh water from ocean water, better than getting fresh water from wastewater. And as far as I can understand, wastewater comes out well ahead, no matter which way you look at it. And so the fact that, yes, you have a big ocean there, but you also have a continuous stream of wastewater that currently it's a lose-lose because most of the Chennai's open streams are actually open drains. And so there's a real big potential for a win-win there if somehow that water could be recovered. And I think with the investments that, you know, globally that are being made by, say, Gates Foundation and so on, in really trying to improve resource recovery from wastewater, I think there's a much bigger a potential there than in ocean water, only because we completely haven't understood the impacts of, as you mentioned, brine in creating dead zones in the ocean. Mm-hmm. I wanted to also respond, if you would allow me to the caller talking about politicians and their ability to make money. To make one really quick point, India has built about 5,000 dams since independence. And we have barely, and I would say almost had no post-facto evaluation studies of any dam in India. And in general, I would say that the research base that feeds into and informs this in a serious, thoughtful, quantitative way simply does not exist. And so we need better data, better accounting, and really serious look at how our infrastructure projects function. The corruption side is one thing, but do they even do what they're supposed to do?
Right.
And I think a lot of these knee-jerk reactions saying, let's bring water from here and there, are all very good until you go and actually look at how past projects have fared. And the answer is probably not very well.
Well, I want to see if I can get one more call here. Let's go to Bill, who's calling from New Orleans. Bill, you're on the air.
Hi. I think that the most recent words spoken were pretty much to the point. What needs to be in place is some sort of a large-scale plan. There's a need to know how much water is coming into the Chennai area, groundwater, surface water, desal, whatever. So you have a fixed amount that's essentially coming in. You need to know how much is going out naturally, and you need to know what the consumption is. It's not eye surgery. The simple equation is the water that flows in minus the water that flows out gives you whatever is the change in storage. And if you have more being abstracted by human use than comes in, you're depleting the system, mm-hmm. and you've got to adapt the system to deal with that sort of situation. So the first thing to do is how much is coming in, how much are we pumping, and how much is going out.
Well, Bill, thank you so much for your call. Professor Agarwal and Veena Srinivasan, we just have about a minute and a half left here. And Professor Agarwal, let me turn to you first. Your point earlier about what lessons Chennai can teach the rest of the world, I think that's exactly right. And I'd want to hear more from you. Are there other lessons that Chennai's current crisis can be taught to the rest of the world?
Yes, I think just following up on what the last caller was talking about, the need for better data. And this is a broader lesson for all cities around the world. I'm here in Tempe, Arizona, and we've had we have been in a long-term drought for several years, and there is the same issue of how do you get the data? Because several agencies that have these data don't collaborate among themselves. So the need for better data and research to find out ways, that is, I think, critically needed all over the world. Mm.
And Veena Srinivasan, we have 30 seconds left. Same question to you. What can Chennai teach the rest of the world?
Well, I think Chennai is a cautionary tale on what happens when you don't plan well and when you don't do the things that we already know we should be doing, which is manage your four taps well, regulate groundwater, treat and reuse your wastewater, harvest and figure out how to use your stormwater, and then your pipe water, manage it efficiently with metering and pricing. And if you've got your four taps figured out with a proper plan, I think you're halfway to solving the problem.
Well, Veena Srinivasan, fellow at the Ashoka Trust for Research in Ecology and the Environment, Bangalore, where she leads the Water, Land and Society program, joining us from Bangalore, India today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Professor Rimshim Agarwal, joining us from Tempe, Arizona, Associate Professor at the School of Sustainability at Arizona State University. Great pleasure to speak with you, Professor. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.